The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. Welcome to IMC. So this morning I'd like to do a Dharma talk that's a bit of an exercise, and perhaps it's an exercise you could participate in, and in a sense maybe the exercise is applied to myself, and you could try to apply the exercise to yourself as you listen, and maybe you can do the exercise in parallel as I go through it. And the exercise is based on an idea that it does appear in the ancient texts of Buddhism, that two things might look very similar and be confused as being the same, but actually they might be quite different, even though they look similar. And the classic representation of this, or example of this, has to do with what's called the four kinds of love, the Brahmaviharas. They have what's called the near enemy. And the near enemy are the things which are kind of the opposite, but they look so similar that people confuse them for these kinds of love. And so loving kindness is one of these forms of love, metta, and that certain kinds of affection, certain kinds of attached affection or desirous affection looks like love, but maybe has more to do with the attraction to pleasure or other things that we want in our relationship. And so it gets confused. We say it's love, but it's actually not, or something. And with compassion, sometimes what gets confused with compassion is dismay or discouragement or being horrified by the suffering out there. The karuna by itself has no sense of dismay or discouragement or there's nothing negative in the experience of karuna, this compassion. It actually feels when it comes through us, even though we're in touch with suffering and somehow feeling the suffering of others, there's a feeling of it being clean or pure or something as it moves through us. There's no dismay that's built into it. But we confuse the dismay with compassion. So, make sense? So the exercise has to do with not the near enemies, but maybe we'll call them the near friends of the hindrances. Not that they're friends of the hindrances, they could be, but there are friends that look like the hindrances. And sometimes when people hear Buddhist teachings, they'll take them in, and then they apply things to those teachings inappropriately. So they think that, I can't do this thing, or because it looks like it's the same thing. So there are things that can look like the hindrances, but are not hindrances. And so rather than being upset that they're there or concerned that somehow we're caught in the hindrances, we can recognize them as being actually beneficial. So the five hindrances are the five things that hinder our wisdom. They also the five things which hinder our ability to get concentrated, and our ability to have clear mindfulness, to be really present in the present moment in a clear, direct way. And in this Buddhist tradition of ours, the meditation tradition, these five hindrances are talked about over and over again because of their tremendous importance. And in fact, people who do a lot of mindfulness practice, it helps if you become an expert on the hindrances. They're like the thing that you should kind of like get a PhD about. Because if you really understand how they work in your own mind, then you're less likely to be tricked by them. You're less likely to be pulled into them. And so if you have an opportunity to study a hindrance, do so, as opposed to try to get rid of it as quickly as you can. Because if you get rid of it as quickly as you can, or try to avoid it too quickly or too much, then we don't learn the ins and outs of it, the tricks of the mind in relationship to it, how we get pulled into its orbit and such things. So the five hindrances are usually listed as sensual desire, Sometimes people just say desire, but it's sensual desire. Aversion, sloth and torpor, even though it's two, it's considered one, hindrance. Restlessness and regret or remorse. And doubt, it's the fifth one. And so these are things that the mind gets caught up in and get preoccupied with. And so in that preoccupation, it's hard to come mindfulness to shine forth or to be seated in mindfulness or in concentration to see clearly, to be settled, to be focused, and to be really here in a clear way. So we have to recognize how we get caught in thoughts of sensual desire and swept away in those, how we get caught in aversion and anger and resentment, and how sloth and torpor kind of makes it really hard for us to be present, how restlessness, agitation, and also this thing called remorse, it pulls us into its orbit and we get preoccupied with that. And they say that doubt is the most dangerous of the hindrances because doubt can come with a lot of authority and can cause people to give up the practice, give up meditation session or give up the practice as a whole because there's so much doubt going on and we're caught in the grip of that doubt. So the exercise is to look for the opposites of these, or another opposite, but those things which look like them, but which are actually beneficial. And we might get confused about what they are. So with sensual desire, there's a few things that get confused with it. First, the word sensual implies that it has to do with desire around sensuality. And that could certainly be around sex, but it can be about sights and sounds and tastes and touch and even the sensuality of having great thoughts and ideas and creativity in the mind. And some people get pulled into the orbit, get caught up in the pleasure of the things they're involved in. And some people want comfort, they're attached to pleasure, and they're seeking it out. And I think it's probably fair to say that it's a much bigger deal in our society than most people will recognize. And probably it's a bigger deal maybe in some of your own lives than you've quite appreciated up to this point because it's kind of just taken for granted or something. And so to the degree to which sensual pleasure, when we can get attached to it, it's considered to be a hindrance. And so and people who are learning to meditate, they're learning how to step away from the hindrances, so they don't hinder us, don't get involved. But there are things that can look like it. And some of them is that there are pleasures that come with being on the spiritual path. There are pleasures that come with meditation. And because they can have a physical component to them, a physical kind of pleasure, they're associated with a kind of sensual pleasure that in meditation we're trying to, not get caught in or in the grip of. So there's meditative pleasure that can arise. There's also, yesterday I spent some time sitting at the edge of a lake, a little lake. But the water was very peaceful, there was kind of greenery around it. And it had a very serene, peaceful feeling to be there and quiet. I was with some people, but it felt just like we shouldn't talk because it was just so nourishing to be there. It was a great pleasure to be there. But it wasn't the sensual pleasure that was important, was nourishing, but rather there was a deep sense of nourishment, of goodness, of peacefulness that was welling up inside of me looking at the scenery. And that was very pleasant to experience. That pleasure, I would say, was a healthy pleasure. It's kind of like taking vitamins or something, it was a good thing to do and take it in. Very different than the pleasure of, of what we might call sensual pleasure that some people are involved in, that we have them and then we want more. Or we have them and they make us restless and agitated, and we get caught in the grip of wanting that and planning it and getting it and all that. What comes to mind sitting here is some of the sensual pleasure that I had when I was a teenager in relationship to certain people. And I would say that my mind got pretty contracted and pretty tight and pretty motivated around trying to pursue those particular pleasures. It was not nourishing. It was not conducive to the deeper peace and well-being. So there are people who can think that they can feel this welling up of this pleasure of meditation, the pleasure of spiritual life, the pleasure of maybe being in nature, a deep kind of sense of goodness that can arise in relationship to other people, sitting and talking with people, being with people. And there's not a sensual pleasure involved or sensual desire, but there is something really wholesome that's welling up. And the desire for that, the wish for that, the pursuit of that, is actually a very important part of a healthy life and a good thing. The fact that we want it doesn't mean that it's necessarily wrong, but rather it's how we want it, how the desires we have are engaged in. So the desire of sitting there at the lake and continue to sit there was very simple and relaxed, and it did not involve a contraction. My mind didn't get preoccupied. I wasn't involved in planning and strategizing, and I wasn't trying to think about how to squeeze every possible little ounce of pleasure out of that lake. I felt good to be there. It felt appropriate to linger there and be with it, and there was a desire for it, and that desire had a feeling of goodness in it. So the fact that it's a desire doesn't make it a hindrance. The fact that it was sensual in a certain kind of way didn't qualify it as what Buddhism calls sensual desire, kamachanda. So this could happen in meditation, these things, all kinds of ways. And it's good to recognize that these can arise without being a hindrance. And we know they're not a hindrance because we're not fixated on them. We're not preoccupied by them. We don't get lost in the world of fantasy and thoughts and ideas when they occur. We stay in a more open and relaxed way. So one of the ways that I think of healthy desire, and maybe healthy desire for this kind of what's going to be called spiritual pleasure, I use the word aspiration. I don't know how it resonates with you, the word aspiration, but for me it's a beautiful word, partly because I love my breathing. And the word, aspiration comes from the word, Latin word for breath, like respiration, and inspiration also comes from that. And so the idea that when the breathing is relaxed and at ease, or when there's aspiration, that kind of desire, it allows the breathing continue to be at ease and open and soft and comfortable. When there's attachment connected to desire, when there's clinging and craving, it affects the breathing, and the breathing becomes contracted and tight. And so the quality of the breathing can be a wonderful measure, a wonderful guide about how we go through our lives. And if you get used to being present and mindful, and mindful of breathing, you'll get a tremendous amount of information from your breathing that tells you what's going on in your inner life, simply from the fact that the breathing's gotten contracted or held, or the breathing is flowing easily. So the desire so this word of aspiration. So the near friend, our friend, looks close to a sensual desire, are forms of aspiration, which are healthy to have, and forms of pleasure, which are also healthy and nourishing to have. And so to distinguish those, then we can prioritize or we can support the ones that are healthy. And then it gets interesting with the second hindrance, which is aversion. The actual word in Pali, ancient language, is probably more like ill will than it is aversion. And the reason why that's important is that it's healthy to avert from some things. Avert means in Latin to turn away. And some things should be turned away from, as opposed to going towards or just continue as they are. Some things are unhealthy. So if I'm sitting there at the lake and feeling this peacefulness, and it feels like it's nourishing me and supporting me and cleaning out some of the gunk that's built up over the day, and I feel like, then I suddenly notice, I have a lot of sensual pleasures to pursue. there's all these good things out there in the world, the playground, and let me go down to the local liquor store, and that's a kind of nice pleasure. And I think there's something great on TV, and you go through the list of things, right? And so, then I could naively take some Buddhist teaching, and say, well, I'm just supposed to accept everything, so I'll just accept my mind is going down this direction, and so let's go to the closest liquor store. This is not healthy. So in that situation, the averting, I say, no, I don't need to go, my mind doesn't need to go down that track. I don't have to be involved in that kind of thinking. In fact, to be involved in that thinking restricts how much I'm being nourished by this wonderful little scene where I'm sitting here next to this water. And so there's an averting, there's a turning away. So sometimes I believe that some practitioners feel like they're never allowed to avert from anything, turn away from anything, because they believe it's the so-called hindrance of aversion, because we use that word, that language. But if we use the word ill will, then it may be a little easier to understand. Ill will is one thing, but averting doesn't have to have any ill will in it. In fact, it has goodwill in it. I have goodwill for myself. I'm taking care of myself by turning away from, going 90 miles an hour to the liquor store or something. And the Buddha was a... sometimes I think he was a trickster kind of character, because he does a lot of wordplay and kind of plays with the words, and probably in ways that shocked people then just as much as sometimes it shocks people today. So I remember there's one place where the Buddha says that he teaches intolerance. if I put a big sign in front of IMC and said, come here and we'll teach you intolerance. Yeah, that would get some, some aversion maybe. And then he goes on, so he has people's attention by saying that, and then he says, I teach intolerance for greed, hatred, and delusion. And so there's a particular mind states, like the hindrances, which we're not supposed to be tolerant of. But the intolerance is not supposed to have any ill will, not supposed to have any clinging to it, but it's just a healthy turning away. Not this. I don't have to be involved in this. So here too, people who learn these teachings about the hindrances or learn teachings about naive acceptance feel like they're not supposed to ever have any turning away from things or say no to things. We're supposed to just be with the way things are. But there's healthy turning away. The third hindrance is sloth and torpor, which sometimes people refer to as sludge, or or swamp-like mind, or in the swamps. And this is where there's such lethargy in the body and the mind that it's hard to do anything physically. It's hard to do something mentally, and can't get the mind kind of going to be mindful and be present, to be concentrated. And it's supposed to be different than ordinary tiredness, which, is just a physical thing that can happen. I like to think of sloth and torpor as a little bit as a strategy of the subconscious mind, a strategy of avoidance, a strategy of somehow not really dealing and being present with things. And so we kind of shut down and, not really going to deal with what's happening. And so this is also considered a hindrance. And so what's the near friend of that, of sloth and torpor? Sometimes when people are feeling quite settled and peaceful and contented in their lives, and especially in deep meditation, they can feel a tremendous stillness of the body, where it feels like, I don't want to move the body. The body doesn't want to move. I don't want to move the body. It's just the best thing in the world is just to sit here unmoving in this body. The bell rings at the end of the sitting and, I'm not moving. I'm here. And some people will take that because they're supposed to get up and move around. Okay, now I'm caught. This must be sloth and torpor because I'm not motivated to do anything. I just feel unmotivated. I feel like I just want to sit here forever. But in fact, it actually can be a very healthy and nourishing state to be in there, to finally have a state of being where we're not always being driven, always wanting to go to the next thing and accomplish things and prove ourselves or get something, but we're just kind of completely here in a settled, solid, contented way. And then mentally, contentment, deep contentment, can be confused with sloth and torpor for the same reason, that when there's a deep layer of contentment, we don't want to do anything. It's like, why do anything when things are perfect? the idea of not being motivated and not having a lot of aspiration in doing something can be, can seem like socially unacceptable. And like, I'm supposed to be, so here I'm sitting peacefully after lunch at a retreat center maybe and looking out and just feel very contented and peaceful, and the bell rings calling us back to meditation. And I don't want to go anywhere. I feel perfectly content. It's not acceptable. I must be caught in the hindrance because I just don't want to do anything. I don't want to go to the sitting. In fact, it might be the opposite, that if we're unfamiliar with this kind of deep state of contentment, it's really good to stay in it and be familiar with it and let it kind of wash through us and benefit us. And so maybe it's better to stay there and not go to the sitting. I've heard that in one of the Southeast Asian countries, Theravadan countries, that they, I don't know if it's true, but I've heard now a number of times from people that there's been an attempt by the government to prohibit Buddhist monks from teaching about contentment. Because the fear is that if people are too content, they won't be productive at work. And lately I've seen one or two articles about this mindfulness, secular mindfulness movement in America, that now people are becoming a little bit concerned that if people learn this mindfulness too much in the corporations at work, they're going to be too content. and they're not going to want to be productive and ambitious and, all this stuff. And it's important to be ambitious and, So so this idea that, contentment maybe is a problem, and is an issue, that's why some people might confuse sloth and torpor with a contentment, peace, stillness. And then there's the fourth hindrance is restlessness and regret or remorse. And restlessness feels quite uncomfortable. A lot of energy coursing around, jumping around, bouncing around. We can't be settled physically, can't get settled mentally. Sometimes the legs feel like they want to bolt, all kinds of things that go on. And it's quite uncomfortable. It's hard to meditate in that state. So what is it that might look similar to restlessness and remorse? So in terms of restlessness, physical and mental restlessness, there can be a strong drive for liberation, a strong drive to practice, a strong drive to going on retreat, or a strong drive to going to meditate. But this is really important for people. It's like maybe some people it becomes for maybe the most important thing in their lives. And so the strong, all the energy to do it that gets awoken gets confused. And well, I'm not supposed to have so much energy. I'm not supposed to have so much drive or movement inside of me. This is what I want to do. And it might feel a little bit restless because that's the direction things are going. I remember when I was, it took a long time for me to get my visa. It was a meditation visa to go meditate in Burma. That was the most important thing in my life at that juncture of my life, was to get to Burma to do long retreats. So it took a long time to get it, and I finally received the visa from the embassy, Burmese embassy in Bangkok. They stamped it. And then I left the embassy, and I was walking down the street, and I started skipping down the street and singing to myself. I was so happy. Now, maybe I could have, been, good Buddhist, and I shouldn't be, I should just be calm and settled and not skipping and singing and all that. But, maybe if I'd held myself still, I think I would have felt this energy building up. I think that enthusiasm, that delight, that something that I'd been wanting for so long that was so important for me in a good way was finally possible, to give that expression and that skipping and singing, I don't think that was being restless. That was just delight and enthusiasm that was coursing through me. And I know to confuse the two means that maybe you should always look placid. You know, you should always, you know, just kind of be still and calm and equanimous and, or something. And so there are energies inside of us which are appropriate and healthy that can be maybe confused with restlessness. And then the regret thing is interesting. Why regret is a hindrance is some people will look back at what they've done earlier in their lives, either they've caused harm or they didn't pursue certain things they wish they'd pursued, and they beat themselves up. I like the word remorse for this rather than regret, because the Latin for remorse is to chew again. So we're chewing ourselves over and over again, like morsel, I guess, remorse. And so we're chewing, grinding ourselves up. But there could also be healthy regrets. There is something about recognizing, I took the wrong turn there. I went down the wrong way. I did the wrong thing. I said the wrong thing. I feel bad about that. And in feeling bad about it, I have regrets, and I want to do better in the future. I want to learn from that so that I can improve. Without some reviewing and some taking in and some feeling that something was off there, maybe even feeling uncomfortable about something that we've done, maybe that we're not giving ourselves a chance to have the energy or the motivation to learn from that and do better in the future, to change and be something different. And so the fact that we feel uncomfortable there is a way of feeling healthy regret. And not all regrets are a hindrance. Some regrets are actually fuel and food for the very path of practice, for the path of becoming a better person. And so I've sat and meditated, and what awoke for me sitting there was some of the things I regretted having done. And I took it that this is appropriate that I'm feeling this. Rather than feeling this shouldn't be happening, this is a hindrance, I should somehow get over it so I can really do the meditation and be blissed out. This is appropriate. The healthy thing here to do now is to really face up to this and allow this to be present and to learn from it, to move through it, let it be processed. So it needs its time rather than treat it as a hindrance. This is actually a support, a friend. So then the fifth hindrance is doubt. And sometimes it's translated as uncertainty, the kind of uncertainty where we don't know what to do. We can't choose what to do, like, this or that. Should I meditate on the breathing? Should I do loving kindness? Should I do open awareness meditation? Should I get up and do the walking meditation? And we get up and do a walking meditation, and, well, should I do walking meditation? Should I go back and sit, whatever. The whole range of doubts that people can get caught up in life. And they can be quite powerful and hold a big grip on us. So what is it that can look like doubt, be confused with it? So what occurs to me, looking at my own life, is that sometimes the experience of not knowing something, I thought, that if I don't know it, then I have doubt. If I don't know what to do, then that must be doubt. And I have to somehow correct for this. But I've learned that there's a healthy state of not knowing. We don't have to know everything. In fact, we can come to a very healthy place of not knowing, where, kind of like the word aspiration, where there's not knowing that's kind of open and present for possibilities. They're just available. And actually can see much clearly because it doesn't know. Where it maybe doesn't know what the next step is or what the next thing to do is, but it's okay because we're present and available and paying attention. And the not knowing is actually very supportive because we can take in more of the situation. We can learn from more of it. If we know too many things, sometimes it's too easy to narrow our focus. Too easy, I know, let me tell you. I can't tell you how many times I've known what I should tell someone. I know what the story is. I know what's the thing is. And let me tell you. But then I've held my tongue, I haven't said anything, and I learned more about the situation, and I realized, Gil, you didn't have all the information. It was actually more complicated, or there are options than I realized. I'm sure glad I didn't speak. And we learn more here. So not knowing can allow for fuller understanding, and fuller something. So the idea that not knowing is a, can look like doubt because we don't know what to do, and therefore, you know, we might try to get rid of it. We think it's a problem. But there's healthy not knowing. And in fact, I think that as we practice, there's more and more comfort with not knowing in certain ways, in certain situations. And that comfort with not knowing is really important. People always need to know, it gets too close to always needing to be in control or always needing to kind of make ourselves safe. And not knowing then doesn't cut up in the trap of, you know, always pursuing control of the situation or safety in the situation. So that's my exercise, my playing out the exercise. And there might be better ways, better connections between hindrances and the things that are our friends that look like them. And certainly I bet for some of you, it's better connections for you in your life. So I hope that if you didn't do the exercise along with me as I spoke, maybe it's something that you'll try on your own at home, or go talk with a friend and kind of try to find your own ideas of what's true for you in your life. And to conclude these words, I think this is very valuable to differentiate between these things, because what we're trying to do in this practice is we're trying to find a way forward so some of the best qualities of our heart, of our mind, can come forth. We're trying to find a way to some of the fullest capacities we have of being at peace, being free, being at home in our own hearts, settled. The fullest capacity of really being in this universe so that when we die, we can die with an open, relaxed heart that in a kind of certain sense is there to be available for the experience of dying, to use a more dramatic example. But in any moment in our life, whether it's sitting at a lake or sitting in rush hour traffic, to find this place of deep inner well-being and freedom, it's a beautiful thing. And to find that, it's not an easy thing to do, an easy thing to stay in touch with. It requires a lot of mindfulness, a lot of settledness, and then it takes a lot of self-study. This is not meant to be a shortcut to all this. The Buddha emphasized over and over again, the way to become wise is to become wise about how we get caught, how the hindrances work. And as we do so, then we maybe can learn to recognize then the opposite, that which is unhindering, that which leads us to an unhindered place in our lives, in our hearts. So, we have a few minutes here. Maybe it might be nice to take just a short few minutes. If any of you did the exercise along with me, if you came up with some other good near friends of the hindrances that I didn't mention that might be nice to name here in the room.
I came up with gratitude, which is a big one for me. Gratitude. I know that when I get caught up and I get angry or I have pet peeves, then I start thinking about what's going well and what's great and what I'm really happy about in my life. And it really works to change, to get me uncaught.
Great. Gratitude. That's very nice. So someone else. I hope you haven't all, most of you settled into not knowing too quickly.
When you were speaking about sensual desire, I thought about play. Just play being kind of a sensual experience, but being very wholesome and fun and lighthearted. So.
Great. It's a wonderful play.
Along with gratitude, I like the word appreciation. Mm. And when I get, when I experience a situation that it works against me or I make a mistake, I can be grateful and appreciate that experience because it, both the negative and the positive experiences, because both of them are pieces that I learn from.
Fantastic. So appreciation for learning opportunities. And Joe, you can move to the this woman here. But go ahead, Trudy.
Okay. When I get into that place where I know and I have to know everything, and I can feel the energy of that, the negativity of that, and one thing I've learned to do is say the words, release the need to understand.
Nice. Thank you. So we had someone, maybe two more, maybe this, if you can move it here, right there. And then after that, you, yeah?
I thought about surprise when you talked about aversion.
Uh-huh.
And a specific example is when I'm a little bit scared of having a conversation, a difficult conversation, because I think I know how they're going to react. And I've already went through my mind like, oh, they're going to say this, and I'm going to say that, and you have all this prepared dialogue, and then you're surprised rather than react with aversion.
Fantastic, surprise.
Yep.
The delight of surprise. So back up there, that would be the last one. And yeah.
Is
a bit.
I think now it's better. When you were talking about hindrances and friendly hindrances versus actual hindrances, I was thinking about situations and circumstances that you go through in life, and even in the hardest of those situations, there's a lot of unknowns. If you continue to believe that life and these experiences are working for you and not working against you, it gives you tremendous strength.
So it reminds me about the concept of faith. And faith sometimes is considered to be a form of desire that's healthy, because faith has faith in what's possible or the direction we're going. So that reminds me. Yes.
What I was thinking about is yesterday I put on a dinner party, and it was to share a travel experience. So I spent a lot of time organizing it and working on the food, and you know, there's a lot of tension in that, like, can I get it right? And yet there's also this, you know, there's this reason why I'm trying to get it right, which is because it's for the benefit of these other people. So I think that would be maybe like a near friend. There's kind of this tension. When you're doing something for somebody else, you want to get it right. You can get really tense. You can overthink it. But on the other hand, there's also this aspect of your motivation is to get it right for somebody else or to share something.
Yeah. So sometimes,
that's a tricky one.
Yeah, I think so. And sometimes hard work can be, you know, hard work. But it's not necessarily a problem to do it that way, to experience that.